Happy Friday. It's Central Time, and I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk with Florida's Secretary of State about how it was his state was able to have votes all counted up on election night. And then Wisconsin's former longtime chief election official contrasts that with how things work in our dairy state. But now it's Food Friday, and this week we are taking you to the Mediterranean. Our next guest has been eating and cooking Mediterranean food her whole life, and she shares it with us today, some of her favorite dishes that she wants you to try. And you can join our conversation with your questions. If you've got a favorite Mediterranean dish, share it with us this afternoon. Have you tried following the Mediterranean diet? What questions do you have about Mediterranean cooking, spices, and what you might want to have on hand? Call us 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can always email us ideas at WPR.org. Susie Carace is the founder of TheMediterraneanDish.com, a Mediterranean food and lifestyle site, and she's with us today to talk about her new cookbook, New York Times bestseller, The Mediterranean Dish, 120 bold and healthy recipes you'll make on repeat. And Susie, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me. I'm super excited to be here.
Yeah, I really enjoyed your story, and I'd love for you to share a little bit with us this afternoon. You grew up in Egypt, and can you talk about some of your experiences with food growing up there?
Yeah, sure. So I grew up right on the shores of the Mediterranean in Egypt in a cosmopolitan Mediterranean city called Port Said, which is the north entrance to the Suez Canal. And there I was lucky enough to be exposed to all sorts of flavors from all over the Mediterranean. A port city, the way you live in a port city is really just kind of all about the foods that nature has given us. We ate a lot of seafood. And I remember going with my father to the market multiple times a week, just checking out the fresh produce and all the sunny flavors. And naturally, countries of the Mediterranean, or at least for sure port cities, they share a lot of excitement around food. And so we ate a lot of Greek-influenced flavors, Italian, Turkish, North African. I had it all, and it wasn't really with a ton of thought around where this came from, but it was just like a ton of enjoyable food. And so I grew up with all that. My mom was a great cook. My dad made sure I understood how to select the best produce and all of that good stuff. So yes, I'm so fortunate.
Yeah, that's part of the story. And then there's the part where you come to Canada and you end up in Michigan and you learn that sharing this food with everybody else becomes a connector, which is universal.
Yes, absolutely. And to be honest, and I feel like most people would probably resonate with this, the idea of getting around, sitting around the table and sharing a meal together, there's really nothing like it. And if you wanted to get to know somebody, you sat at the table. And that's how I grew up. My parents were very big into hospitality, as with many parts of the Mediterranean and the Middle East. And we've had a lot of friends and strangers at our table. And so naturally for me, I would just invite people to try my food, and I made a lot of friends doing that.
Susie Carace is the founder of TheMediterraneanDish.com, and she has a New York Times bestseller, the new cookbook, The Mediterranean Dish, 120 bold and healthy recipes you'll make on repeat. And you can join the conversation at any time at 1-800-642-1234. And Susie, okay, what are a few pantry essentials that we'd want to have on hand if we were to start doing some Mediterranean cooking? What do we have to have?
You know, that's such a great question, because a lot of people may not think that they have a lot of the ingredients to make Mediterranean food already in their pantries. So, for example, for me, the all essential extra virgin olive oil is a big deal in eating the Mediterranean way, but also some of the very simple, very humble ingredients in your pantry, such as canned beans or grains, or even, you know, dried beans as well. is another one. And obviously lots of veggies and fruits in your fridge. And I guess I'm lumping in the fridge section as well.
Sure.
The flavor makers for me have got to be a lot of garlic,
yep,
a lot of citrus, and a lot of fresh produce, and especially herbs. So I think if people were to just kind of like sift through some of the things they have in their pantry and in their fridge, you'd be surprised how easily it is to cook a Mediterranean meal with what you have on hand.
All right, Susie, and our recipes that our guest is sharing with us today can be found anytime at wpr.org/foodfriday. So keep that in mind, because I've told people we're going to tell them about the smoothest, fluffiest hummus today, Susie. And you have that as one of your recipes in your new cookbook. So what does that mean? I think most people get the gist. There's some extra virgin olive oil. You've got some chickpeas. You've got some tahini. You've got some citrus in there. But what is it that makes it? And you can find the full recipe on the website or in Susie's cookbook. What is it that makes it the smoothest and fluffiest? What do you do different?
Yes, I'm going to share this credit because I learned it from my mother-in-law, Mama Dina, who is really a master of the Middle Eastern kitchen. She grew up in Jordan and actually ran a couple of restaurants in Michigan for a while. And I learned from her a couple of major tips when you're making homemade hummus. First of all, making sure that you peel the chickpeas. It does actually make a difference. I get lazy sometimes and I don't always do it. But when I do it and I take a minute to just take care of that, of those peeling the chickpeas, it does make a difference in the final texture and it's extra smooth. But as you are making the hummus in the food processor, one thing that I've learned from her or watching her do it, she drops a couple of ice cubes from the top of the food processor as the hummus is processing. And this really just gives it that fluffy, whipped, really light texture as if you were making ice cream. And it is the funnest thing to try. So definitely those two tips. And even if you end up using canned chickpeas, which I do, I mean, because dry chickpeas will require you to soak them overnight and then you're going to cook them and whatever. But if you end up using canned chickpeas, which are a fine option here, I also do end up cooking them for a little bit, 15, 20 minutes or so. That will actually allow them to be extra tender, which is also another trick for, I guess, kind of faking it into making hummus from scratch, but without really using dried beans and taking the time to soak them. So those are the three tips, and that's how I make it today.
Homemade pita or store-bought pita?
Well, unless you have an amazing Middle Eastern bakery by you, you're probably not going to have the freshest pita. The pita I grew up with at home in Egypt, we actually bought every single day. And my father was adamant about this. He would just only buy 5 pitas per day. And it was like one of these things where it's like, no, we have to have it fresh. So every morning someone had the chore of getting the fresh pita, and it was puffy and pillowy and absolutely delicious. And it's also part of the culture of like not wasting. That was a big deal too growing up. But here in the States, it's kind of hard to find really good fluffy fresh pita unless you do live near a Middle Eastern bakery. So you can easily make it at home, and it's not hard. It's a very basic recipe. It's in the book, and I do make it often, and sometimes I'll make a larger batch and freeze it, and it freezes very well.
The recipe that I made last night from your cookbook, Susie Karacha, is the harissa red lentil and tomato soup. It was easy, it was affordable, and it was delicious. And as you, our technical director, Sarah Hopeful, is dining on it right now with a little bit of crusty bread on the side. It's just perfect. But what is it about these spices that all go together to create that full flavor?
Yeah, so obviously lentils, they're kind of almost neutral flavored, right? So you want to, but they're so filling and satisfying and they will give you some good nutrition. So in this particular recipe, I rely on harissa paste, a North African condiment, so to speak, that kind of just gives it that extra zing, a little bit more spice. And it just finishes it so well that everything comes together. It's so coherent. Another thing that I love to add to a lot of my soups, and in this one as well, I think like a little bit of citrus will round out the flavor too.
That lime, and then you add the cilantro on top, and it gives it a fresh pop right above the kick of the spice of the harissa. That is something that we will be enjoying throughout this entire chili weekend. It's a nice hearty meal.
Yes, absolutely. And also, like you said, super affordable. And a lot of people are looking at the cost, a rising cost of food these days. And again, another plug for lentils and legumes in general. They are pretty affordable and very satisfying. And the way that we eat, Mediterranean way of eating, is very humble food for the most part, and not super expensive.
It's Food Friday, and we're breaking bread with Susie Carace with her new cookbook, The Mediterranean Dish, 120 bold and healthy recipes you'll make on repeat. And you can find those recipes that we're sharing with you this afternoon online anytime at WPR.org/Food Friday. And if you have a question for our guest chef today, 1-800-642-1234. If you have a Mediterranean dish that you'd like to share, 1-800-642-1234. We have more for you when we continue here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and we're picking up our talk with Susie Carace about her new cookbook, The Mediterranean Dish, 120 bold and healthy recipes you will make on repeat. And if you've got a question or if you've got a dish you'd like to share, Food Friday, it's time to do it. 1-800-642-1234. And Susie, let's move on to your next dish. This one I am dying to try, and you have to explain it a little bit for us. Cheater's Hawashi Pitas. What are these?
Okay, well, Hawashi is a very Egyptian meal. It's also one of those street foods that I grew up with. And if you were to make it the proper way, not the cheater's way, you would make a dough from scratch, and you would fill it with this beautiful meat mixture, ground beef mixture that is filled with spices, a little bit of hot pepper, and all that jazz. You make it into a patty, and you kind of encase it with this dough, and it's usually cooked in like a domed clay oven super quick, and it comes out hot, and you are typically standing in a long line of people waiting for this little pie of hawashi. But at home, when I make it, I kind of stick true to the flavors, the big flavors in it, the bold spices, and a little bit of the hot peppers. I actually just use jalapenos here in the state. And I replace the whole making of the dough with just already made pita bread. So I'll cut the pita in half, and I will stick this beautiful meat mixture uncooked into the pita, and you stick it in the oven. And it's a great way to honestly feed a crowd of people on a budget, because you'll stretch about a pound and a half of ground beef to make a good number of hawashi sandwiches. And it takes about 15 minutes or so in the oven. And it is just as exciting for me. And hey, nobody's ever mad about a shortcut. So that's my cheat. Hawashi.
And how about these seasonings? As the recipe details, and again, you can find it at your leisure at WPR.org/Food Friday. Allspice, black pepper, coriander, sweet paprika, ground cardamom, some cumin in there, and some cinnamon too.
Yes.
What's
all
that?
The things, basically.
Oh, yeah, it's a little bit of everything. But what
it's
does
a lot of warm flavors, kind of leans quite North African, if you really look at it. And, and the recipes do vary from one place to another, but this is kind of the recipe that I learned at home, and I have always made it this way, and everyone loves it, but it is pretty bold. When people ask me what is hawashi, I have found myself resorting to this lazy answer of like, well, you know, it's Egypt's way to a hamburger. It's really not, because a hamburger is really well known in Egypt too, as we know it here, just the simple patty on a bun. But this one is a little bit on steroids, I would say, with all the
Susie Carace is the author of the cookbook, The Mediterranean Dish, 120 bold and healthy recipes you'll make on repeat. And you're right about the idea of nafas in Mediterranean cooking. Susie, yes. Can you share that with us?
Yes. The word nafas in Arabic means breath. It also means soul. And if you were to talk about food and creating food and feeding the people around you, and let's say you're in a conversation with one of the tetas, the grandmas in Egypt, and you're wanting a recipe from her, you will never get a precise recipe from anyone, really, but particularly the older generation. And they'll be like, you know, a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and then a whole lot of nefes, meaning just the whole spirit behind creating the food is what really makes it special and delicious. So the idea would be you're breathing into it a lot of love, and you're using a lot of your own God-given intuition. And don't worry so much about the measurement. As long as you're cooking from within, so to speak, with all your soul, and you're excited about generously sharing, the food that you're creating is laced with deliciousness. So I grew up with that idea, and it gives me such joy. And really kind of when I talk about cooking the Mediterranean way or the Egyptian way even, it gives me a lot of like peace in knowing that, hey, you know, if I mess up, at least I tried. I tried my best, and I was having fun doing it, and I'm feeding the people I love. And so it's not a whole lot of following the rules. I grew up more of like, you know, just kind of, you're going to learn how to put these flavors together the more you do it, and just kind of go at it with all your heart and give it all your attention, and it will turn out okay.
So when Susie Carace says a tablespoon of this, a teaspoon of that, a quarter tablespoon of the other thing, what you really...
I'm better now. Well, so the thing is, I started religiously measuring now that I cook for a living and other people are following my recipes. So not to worry, every recipe in the book and on the site has been tested to perfection and has been measured a million times because there are people counting on it.
Absolutely. And so let's move on to the last recipe that we're sharing with our audience from your book today, and that is the charred honeyed apricots with pistachios. This sounds delectable. Is this a dessert?
You know what? I can't honestly even call it a dessert nor a recipe. I cheated my way into it and put it in the book anyway. But it's one of those things that it's like, you know, you've got some good ripe apricots or any stone fruit of your choice. Peaches will work well with this recipe. Mm. And if your sweet tooth is calling for something and you don't have the time to bake, like me, I'm not a huge baker. This is a great recipe to do that. And just a very simple and exciting, yes, let's call it dessert for the sake of being clear here, it is a sweeter option. So I just simply kind of toss it with a little bit of citrus and a little bit of sugar, I think brown sugar, and then you stick it under the broiler for, oh, maybe 5 to 7 minutes, and it kind of bubbles up and gets charred beautifully, and you finish it up with some honey and maybe a little bit of pistachio to just kind of looks a little more fancy than it really is, and it's such a simple, delicious dessert.
Yeah, it's just a handful of ingredients, and it's just a few minutes to throw it all together. And when you're done, I have yet to try this, but it is certainly part of my list now. And again, you can find the full recipe in full detail online at wpr.org/foodfriday. And if you talk about Mediterranean baking, Susie, how would you compare it or make it different from American baking?
Oh, yeah, well, that's a great question. So I, for me, when I think about the way people bake in that part of the world where I grew up, the baked goods are not too sweet. For the most part, they're just right. So, and also, we don't always have a ton of frosting on anything. Like a cake as simple as an olive oil cake without a whole lot on it, but a sprinkle of maybe shaved citrus like oranges and a little bit of powdered sugar is just as exciting to people as something that is layered with, you know, all the frosting. So I feel like we have a variety of things that take just a handful of ingredients and they turn out amazing. I will say my favorite dessert will always and forever be, baklava. And that's the one that I will probably be making during the holiday season. And it's in the book as well. We call it a triple nutty baklava.
Okay. How hard is that? Because from my experience, I cannot make baklava. I'll just say that.
Okay, well, it's actually a lot easier than most people think, because if you envision, have you ever made a lasagna?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so if you envision sort of a layering situation, like a casserole, and you're layering, the pasta, the meat, the whatever, to make a lasagna, think of it in the same terms. You're layering some phyllo cheese, a little bit of nuts with some sugar and cinnamon, and then some more phyllo, and you're kind of just, it's very therapeutic, actually. You're just assembling something in a baking dish. And the biggest thing for me with baklava, and I really have become a sort of a baklava snob, unnecessarily, I suppose, unintentionally, just because of I've eaten it at home more than I have outside. The biggest thing for me is to make sure that as soon as you take the baklava out of the oven, you hit it up with the honey syrup, which allows the cooler honey syrup to be absorbed really well in the layers of flaky hot phyllo dough. Phyllo pastry is very thin to work with, and so a lot of people fear working with it, but if it breaks, nobody cares. So I really highly encourage you to try the recipe in the book. It's very easy.
I will have to give it a try, and I will have to let you know. Susie Karace, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
You're welcome. Glad to be here. Thank you.
You bet. And again, all those recipes that we talked about this afternoon are from Susie Karace's new cookbook, New York Times bestseller, The Mediterranean Dish, 120 bold and healthy recipes you'll make on repeat. And you can find all these recipes we talked about and a link to the cookbook at WPR.org/Food Friday. Now, coming up Monday on the morning show, it is your state capitol report. And Kate Archer-Kent brings you the results of school referenda from across the state with State Superintendent Jill Underley. Also, an investigation into all the ballots that were all the races that were uncontested in Wisconsin on Tuesday and what that means for our democracy. Kate also has cocktails waiting for you on Monday morning, exploring the mixed drinks that have become classics. Find out more Monday morning from 7 to 9 on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And on election night, the state of Florida had conclusive election results, while states like Arizona and Nevada still counting them up. And we've heard over and over again, vote counting can take time. Be patient. We want to get this right, which makes sense. While different states have different laws that end up causing them to count votes at different speeds, the wait times also give people, politicians especially, an opening to question what's going on, to sow doubt in the process. But we want to start in Florida, which some see now as the gold standard in voting and vote counting. It took a look in the mirror after a much less smooth election 22 years ago. So what questions do you have about how vote counting works in Florida versus Wisconsin and other states? Join our conversation, 1-800-642-1234, or email us ideas@WPR.org. Our guest is Cord Byrd. He's the Florida State Secretary of State and was a Florida State Representative for 6 years prior to that. Secretary Byrd, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Lee. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, take us back 22 years up to the Tuesday night. Paint a picture for us. What were some of the issues that caused problems back in 2000 and how Florida addressed those to be what some are considering the gold standard today?
Sure. So I actually spent Election Day in 2000 in Palm Beach County watching voting take place and still have my sample butterfly ballot from 22 years ago. And we had a hodgepodge of laws at the time, and supervisors of elections in the different counties. They had different machines and different standards for counting the votes. And so over the last 20 years, Florida has obviously, because of that, quite frankly, embarrassing experience in 2000, made a consistent and concerted effort to improve our elections and to wind up where we are today, which is we get results quickly and efficiently on election night.
So what are some of those big changes from your perspective, Secretary Byrd?
Sure. So in Florida, we have three options for voting. So we have a vote by mail, early voting, and then obviously Election Day. But our results, the counties can begin canvassing, meaning counting the vote by mail and early votes in the 2 weeks leading up to Election Day. So on election night, that first number that gets reported once our polls close is the vote by mail and early voting. So on election night, all we have to count are the election day results. And I think that's really, really important and has increased the confidence in Florida's elections. And I think that's probably the most important thing that we've done.
Were there arguments in opposition to counting ballots before polls closed on election day, Secretary Byrd?
There's always, when anytime you change election laws, there's always concern. But I think the proof is in the pudding and the results that we have, that it is the right thing to do. And we have very stringent laws and penalties if someone were to release results prior to election night. And that hasn't happened. And the supervisors take their job very seriously. I visited all 67 supervisors of election in their home county after I was appointed in May of this year. To visit with them, to see what security measures they have in place, to meet with their staff. And they all take their job very seriously, and they're all professionals. And we haven't had an issue with counting votes before Election Day.
Some of the arguments we're hearing out west as votes continue to be tabulated are that they want to make sure they verify every signature and every voter is valid. Is that an issue for you in Florida?
It is not. So on our vote by mail ballots, those have to be in by 7 p.m. on election night. So any vote by mail ballots received after that do not get counted. And on election night, those vote by mail ballots can continue to come in. But we have deadlines built into our statutes when the supervisors are to complete that process. So I know we had we were still receiving reports as late as 3:30 a.m., but those were just a handful of ballots that were left to be counted. The vast majority of the 7.7 million had already been tabulated.
Cord Byrd, our guest. He is Florida's Secretary of State, joining us live this afternoon, and you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. And Secretary Byrd, how valuable is it to you, politically, democratically, in any aspect, to have election results quickly?
I think it instills confidence in the voters, and whether you're a Republican or Democrat in Florida or independent, knowing the results on election night is just been, I think, very comforting to voters. And the longer it takes, the more distrust builds in. I think your lead into the discussion here was spot on, that politicians then begin to sow doubt. They start to question, the media starts to question, and then voters start to question. And I just really don't understand why states can't follow the Florida model. We had more voters vote on Tuesday than Nevada has total population. We had twice as many as Arizona has. There really is no reason for states not to be able to get it done on election night.
So what would your advice be to them, Secretary Byrd?
They can come talk to me. They can come talk to our legislature. Our laws are you can find them online. I think that if they follow what we're doing, because it is the right way to go as far as the way we count ballots and the security measures we have in place and the openness. I mean, we have a very open process where citizens get to observe the testing of the machines prior to the election. They can observe the canvassing process all the way through. They get to observe signature verification. So while we have strict laws in place, we also give the public the opportunity to witness this entire process, which once again instills confidence.
Was it a big lift to get voters on board with the changes that have taken place since 2000? How much time did it take?
So it is a continual process. And then, we received some criticism. I was in the legislature the past, 6 years. And, anytime we change election laws, especially after a successful election, like in 2020, people say, well, if we had a great election, why did you need to change? Well, we're always looking to strike the right balance between access and integrity. And so while we look at the things we did right, we find other things that we can improve upon. like the drop boxes. We had a much more lenient drop box law. And then the governor and the legislature decided that we were going to tighten that up because voters do like them, but we needed added security. So it's always just striking, trying to find that right balance of access and integrity.
So with that in mind, Secretary Byrd, what do you think Florida could improve on as we look towards 2024?
Sure. So I think, looking at the with vote by mail, which is a popular method of voting for people in Florida, looking to tighten up the security. Some still question just the signature match. And so we're looking at different options, whether it's another security sleeve on the envelope or putting some type of identification number on the ballot to ensure that that the person who's casting that vote by mail ballot is the person that is the voter.
But you don't have any doubt about the verification that the state of Florida has gone through in verifying, verifying the election results?
No, I have no. We have no question on our certification, and don't see any reason why we wouldn't certify our election results. We have a good process in place that, like I said, is transparent and accurate.
And people seem to be confident about. So, Secretary Byrd, I thank you so much for sharing it with us this afternoon.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to tell you about Florida's success story and help any other states that are looking to maybe change their laws.
You bet. And we're going to refocus on Wisconsin next. Cord Byrd is Florida's Secretary of State. And we're going to hear from Wisconsin's former longtime chief election official, Kevin Kennedy, about how things work a little differently when it comes to counting votes here and a few other states without outstanding votes still rolling in as we speak. Still time for your calls, though, at 1-800-642-1234. What questions would you have about Wisconsin's voting procedures, laws, and when we tabulate the votes? As I understand it, those mail-in or absentee ballots do not start getting counted until after the polls closed, and that to some degree created a vacuum or a void following the 2020 election, especially with votes coming in from Milwaukee and particularly. So if you've got questions for our guest Kevin Kennedy, he is next, and you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and we continue our talk about what accounts for the differences in vote counting across different states. And joining us now, Madison native Kevin Kennedy, who served as Wisconsin's chief election official from 1983 to 2016. He is former director and general counsel of the Wisconsin Government Accountability Board and currently sits on several boards, including the Center for Election Innovation and Research. Kevin, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be back. Thank you, Lee.
Yeah, and you heard our conversation with Florida Secretary of State Cord Byrd. What were some of your thoughts while you were listening?
Well, I thought that he did an excellent job of describing the process in Florida, pointing out their strengths and why they have their results so quickly. Although I would point out that Florida and Wisconsin's results, the unofficial results that were available for the public, pretty much lined up at the same time, even though we have a different approach. We knew what 99% of the vote was in Wisconsin by early Wednesday morning.
But that wasn't necessarily the case just a couple of years ago, and that vacuum led for some speculation and theories to roll in. So did Wisconsin change anything for counting ballots between 2020 and 2022?
They did not change anything in terms of counting the ballots. They made it harder to vote in terms of that, and we saw some challenges in that aspect. But the counting process was the same. I think there might have been more focus in Milwaukee. Obviously, 2020, there were many more absentee ballots to count than there was in 2022. That was one big difference. But it was something that experts in the process and the media, in fact, I participated in a media briefing early on saying you can expect that the results from Milwaukee will come in late in 2020 because under Wisconsin law, they can't start processing those in terms of opening them up and putting them into the tabulators to be counted until 7 o'clock on election day.
And why is that?
Well, it's a recognition, I think, I'm not sure there's a strong policy from it. It's as much as it's the way things have been done, Wisconsin doesn't have an early voting process. Everything is absentee. So when you cast a vote before Election Day, you complete your ballot in front of a witness. If you're doing it in person in the clerk's office, the clerk employee is going to be your witness. And that ballot is going to be sealed and not open till Election Day. And that's really the biggest delay period. In places like Florida, one with true early voting, the voter goes in just like they would on Election Day, mark their ballot, place it into a tabulator, and they secure that so that the results aren't released. The secretary made a good point of that. But they also process their absentee by mail ballots as well. So when they come into the clerk's office, they do the checks that would be done at the polling place. In Wisconsin, maybe there's the benefit that it's double checked once in the office and again at the polling place. But in Florida, once it's checked, then the ballots are fed into the machine. So again, once they're unsealed, those results can be displayed just like we do on election night once all the ballots have gotten through.
Kevin,
again, the delay in Wisconsin just tends to be what's the size of the absentee ballot load?
Kevin Kennedy, our guest, he served as Wisconsin's chief election official from 1983 to 2016. And let's go from Florida all the way to Arizona now. And while we try to assure people that voting takes time in places where it's designed to take time is a good and accurate thing, that time still creates space for some bad actors to question the election's legitimacy. And we saw this in 2020, and we're seeing it again now, including from the Republican candidate for Arizona Governor, Kari Lake, who called election workers there incompetent and accused them of intentionally slowing the results. CNN's Wolf Blitzer asked Maricopa County Board of Supervisors Chairman Bill Gates to respond to that, and here's what he had to say.
It's really sad to hear that we have the Republican nominee for governor here in Arizona who's talking like that. I think, you know, the votes that were just released, 78,000, that doesn't happen magically. It happens because of the people behind me. All the people here in Maricopa County elections who are working so hard. They're working 14 to 18 hour days every day. We're about to go into a holiday weekend with Veterans Day, and they're going to continue to work those kind of hours on the holiday Friday, on Saturday, and Sunday. And I understand that Kari Lake wants us to move quickly, and a lot of people do. But you know what's more important is that this is done accurately. That is the focus. And that, you know, like for all of these mail-in ballots, that those are signature verified. This is very important to me as an elected official, that only eligible people, only eligible votes are counted. I would think that Kari Lake would be interested in that as well. That's something that I ran on the Board of Supervisors. I support ID at the polls. And all those things, they might take a little bit more time.
Kevin Kennedy, as a former Wisconsin chief election official, what are your thoughts about what Bill Gates had to say to Kari Lake?
Well, I think he was spot on in defending the integrity of their system. We saw that the 2020 results stood up to, the very poorly conducted audit that was done post-election by a private group of individuals hired by the legislature to do that. But the delays in Arizona differ from Wisconsin and Florida because they have different rules. They don't start their signature verification, which is a very tedious process, until election day or the day after. And that's really where the delays are. There's a lot of attention paid to make sure that integrity is done. In Wisconsin, we get an ID check before the ballot goes out. We check to make sure that it's witnessed by an individual when it comes in and that witness fully complies. It's checked again at the polling place before it is processed. But we get that checked on election day. And the biggest delay are in the municipalities that don't do it at the polling place. I personally was in charge of a polling place in Madison on election day. And we had 350 absentee ballots that we processed. And I was concerned going into the election whether we'd get that done during the day, but we had them all processed and into the tabulator before 6 o'clock at night, so that when we wrapped up the voting at 8 and transmitted the results to the county clerk, all the absentee totals were in there as well.
Let's go to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234 for our guest, Kevin Kennedy. Heidi in Martin, you're on Central Time.
Hello.
Hi.
I really had a concern about what the gentleman from Florida said when he said they were going to put numbers on the ballots when they mailed them out to verify that that person's number matched the name. Then our ballots are no longer private. Everybody knows how we voted, and that concerns me as a United States citizen.
Heidi, thank you. Aren't ballots numbered, though, Kevin Kennedy? And does that mean that our vote, who we vote for, can be accounted for?
No, our ballots are not numbered. And even in Florida, I think they're trying to adopt the Georgia model. There are some problems with the numbering, not so much because it's tied to the ballot, because the number's not on the ballot. It's on the transmittal envelope. It's no different than having your name on it. The real problem with the numbers, as you're balancing the policy interests, are it's pretty easy to make a mistake copying a 16-digit driver's license number onto that, and you want to make sure that it's set up so, not that it's going to be tied to the ballot, but that other people can't see that number, because that's number that we normally are going to keep from public display. But it's not written on the ballot. It's written on the envelope in which the ballot is contained, and they are separated before they're processed. And when you're looking at ballots after the election, you can't tie the ballot to the envelope. The checking is done ahead of time. I think it's a very good concern that Heidi raises, but it has been addressed. There are some other challenges with using an identifying number versus a witness or a signature verification, or even the ID requirement just to get the ballot.
Heidi, thank you for that call and bringing that to light. And Kevin Kennedy, from your perspective and your work as Wisconsin's former chief election official, as a member of the board of the Center for Election Innovation and Research, what should Wisconsin do to improve its elections?
Well, two things. When it comes to processing the absentee ballots, I think we can look to other states that are processing ballots that are received before Election Day. We can keep the results secure. There's been a strong effort to try and get to allow municipalities to do that. Again, even in Milwaukee, we still had all the results tabulated. It was late in the morning on the day after the election in 2018 and 2020, and even in 2022, but we weren't 2 days, 1 week, or 2 weeks out like we're seeing in some of the West Coast states on that. The other thing is, you know, it's unfortunate, but there's really been an effort to make it more challenging to vote. The elimination of the drop boxes. You know, there are processes to ensure that they are secure, and it is a convenience that is very helpful to voters in terms of returning their ballots. I used to work for the U.S. Postal Service when I was in college, and I understand that sometimes people's confidence, they can think of many bad experiences they personally had with the Postal Service. Being able to deliver a ballot before Election Day and not worrying that it was delayed, the post office will often tell you you need to make sure you mail your ballot a week before the election. That's kind of strange when you're thinking it's just going from the outskirts of Madison to downtown, but it's not the way they process that mail.
Hey, Kevin, thanks so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Happy to do it.
Kevin Kennedy was Wisconsin's chief election official for more than 30 years and currently sits on the board of the Center for Election Innovation and Research, taking a look today about what contributes to the speed of vote counting that we see in Wisconsin, Florida, Arizona, across the board. Coming up Monday on Central Time, Rob's back, and if you're having trouble unplugging, then find out about the new course being taught at Lawrence University. It's called Doing Nothing, and we'll show you how it's done.